Dear Mom, I know you've tried to protect me from who I am, and you've said my life before you adopted me doesn't matter, but it does matter. It matters because I still have visions of the place where I was born. I've heard all the whispers. I know what happened in that town where I was born. And I know you've tried to protect me from its horror for 19 years. Well, today I'm going back to that little abandoned town called Gatlin. Home to the truth. Love, Hannah.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Children of the Corn series, part of the 3-Minute Retrospectives look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King.
Give yourself. It's his will.
Join Garrett.
Don't underestimate the power of my vision.
Matt.
He speaks to me always, but today he is displeased.
And Adam.
Is this how they come to a complete stop in California?
As they find out who of the three of them really agrees with he who walks behind the rose.
He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Will the three podcasters survive this trek through rows and rows of corn?
I got your eternal flame right here!
Find out next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Come on, let's go!
He Who Walks Behind the Rose, we podcast for you. Continuing with Children of the Corn Part 2, The Final Sacrifice. Oh, everyone wishes. Released January 29th, 1993. Budget was $1.3 million. Box office, $7 million. Yes, it made a profit. And this was directed by David Price. Boys, as I previewed all the way back when we did the Lawnmower Man retrospective, the first Lawnmower Man came out, there was a trailer for this. I was like, oh, that looks cool. So, yes, I did go to this opening weekend. Me and my friend were two of maybe three other people in that theater. Yeah, this was a theatrical experience for me. Now, Goudreau, were you aware of this movie? Had you seen it before you... Oh, that's right. You hadn't watched any of these before this retrospective, had you?
No, because I'm not a masochist like you are. And this first of all, this retrospective leads me to believe that you are not a completionist as much as you are a sadist, where we are not doing this because we have to. It's because you want to. So I'm coming into these with almost as much resentment as Adam is.
Now, Matt, that being said, did you recognize the two writers of this particular film?
I didn't recognize much of anything beyond the title, so tell me who these two guys are.
These two guys, Al Katz and Gilbert Adler, they worked a lot on a show that you and I are big fans of, Tales from the Crypt.
Oh.
Gilbert Adler, he did some work on the Superman Returns script. He's been around a bit. He did Valkyrie. He worked on Valkyrie, Ghost Ship, Constantine, he was a writer and producer of. So there's at least a little bit of horror cred recognized with Children of the Corn Part 2. Now, Adam, I assume when this was released to Brendan Theaters, which is where I saw it, you had no idea.
You think?
Yeah, theatrical experience, didn't really remember it that much. I hadn't seen it since then, and you know what? It's weird because they have asked Stephen King about these movies, and he has a really funny quote about him where he was just like, you know what? I kind of wish they didn't make so many of the Children of the Corn sequels. That's one thing I wish they could take back. But there is one he complimented. I'm going to be getting to that one pretty darn soon, so look forward to that.
You know what? I'll say it right here, since it's a rarity. Stephen King, I agree with you. Things Adam has never said on this podcast.
Oh, we've said it a couple times. We've gone over it. But this was also the beginning of the Children of the Corn relationship with Dimension Films. Now, Matt, up until 1996, Dimension Films wasn't really recognized for too many things. It had acquired the Halloween rights as well. They were really big in the horror scene, but from the early to mid-90s, there really wasn't too much horror to write about, and they would take this and just run with it. And we're going to be getting to some movies where they did them just to kind of hold on to the rights. Now, Matt, you and I have discussed horror in the 90s before when we did Child's Play and some of the Texas Chainsaw movies and whatnot. Dimension Films, struggling in the early 90s. What do you feel about Dimension Films acquiring this?
I can see the logic behind it because I sort of equate it to when all the studios were buying up rights to various Marvel properties in the 80s. Not that Stephen King was on the verge of bankruptcy like Marvel, but it was so much in the pop culture consciousness that it made sense for different properties to get dispersed. And this is sort of their first stake in the ground, because this is the same studio that would distribute the vast majority, if not all, of the Hellraiser sequels that went direct to video. Mm-hmm. And they would get... did they have Scream, or was that Miramax?
They had Scream. It was a division of Miramax, and they would pump these things out, man. We're going to get to all of them. I have stories about some of them, because I was working at a video store when a lot of them were being released. But this one, again, theatrical experience. Didn't really watch it afterwards for a while. This was my first viewing of it in quite a while, actually. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump into Children of the Corn Part 2. We open up with a set of credits set to a haunting theme and weird black backdrop. We then see some people go down into a creepy basement where there are some corpses, as we cut to a news report that, if done today, would be done by podcasters. Now, this particular scene, we are discovering these bodies from that first film, aren't we, Matt?
Yes. And this is how the first movie should have opened.
I agree.
Where you see just the aftermath. Granted, this movie doesn't have to put up pretense of hiding who did the murders, but this kind of feels like a retroactive bit of course correction in comparison to the first one. And I like that it actually starts on a more... It's weird how it's a more ominous note, even though it's far less showy.
The problem I had right off the bat is it's a black screen with this going on, and I thought there was something problematic with what I was trying to watch. I thought maybe I was going to get nothing but audio, because it goes on for just too long that it should have, and I didn't understand it. But no, I got a problem with this opening, because to me the time just doesn't seem to match up, and I'm confused as hell as what I think I'm seeing. I know what I'm being told. I'm like, okay, so we're starting with bodies. It's a direct sequel, but it feels like it's hella later than the original one would have finished. So I'm 2 minutes in, and I'm already taking notes of confusion.
I will say, to Adam's point, though, this does not feel like the same Gatlin that we saw in the first movie. If the first movie was Gatlin, this feels like Topeka, where it's like, I know they're in the same range, but they don't feel like the same town. This one feels a lot bigger.
Yes, that's a great point as well. And also, to Adam's point, a lot of horror movies in the late 70s and the 80s, Matt, you and I have covered a lot of them. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre started off kind of like this, where we're discovering things. So I think that's kind of what they're kind of going for here. But Matt, you're absolutely right. And this town's going to change multiple times in the course of this retrospective.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they're going to tell us it's the same place.
This franchise will have the Haddonfield.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a great comparison. So as people of the town are getting interviewed, we are seeing a kid in black just kind of lingering around. We see one little girl getting interviewed, and she says that all she saw was the corn. We then see a boy and his dad. They're driving on the highway. They're arguing, and boy, this kid, he comes off as quite a bit of a jackass. Adam, we talked about this when we talked about Return to Salem's Lot. This is kind of the same dynamic as that, right?
Well, see, I thought you were going to go complete and do a... This is Clark Kent hopping off in the truck to shoot up my dad. This relationship with these two, this kid's an asshole, and the dad's not much better.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dynamic. And I don't believe them as father or son. I feel like we got a 25-year-old and a 35-year-old.
Yeah, this is like that movie The Identical with Ray Liotta, where it's a 50-year-old man yelling at his 35-year-old son. You're way too generous with calling this father and son. And yeah, I hate both of these characters. So, you know, it's a good thing this came out in the 90s, because this is certainly not terms of endearment.
We then see some kids getting tested as they get on a bus, and there's just something off about this bus, and I know that's because of the music that's being played here. We see some adults arguing that the children can't be seen as sympathetic, as years ago they murdered their parents, which is what we saw in the beginning. And this is when we meet Angela, who's going to become a big part of the story, played by Rosalind Allen. And we cut back to the road as a news truck makes fun of our main character, Garrett, for being a tabloid news reporter now. These they came out of nowhere, and they're going to go out of nowhere.
Yeah, this rival production company, which I don't even think this town has enough money for one news station, let alone two.
Yeah.
I wanted to look at these guys and go, guys, they're shooting Twister down the road.
I, you know what? As someone who had just watched that, rewatched that movie, just like right before this, I thought of Twister too as I was watching this. We learn about the kids who killed their parents here in Gatlin, so we're getting some callbacks to that previous film. So, Matt, this is more of a sequel than we thought it was going to be, right?
It's a sequel, but I wouldn't call this a direct sequel because there is a bit of a time jump. But I wonder, I'll ask the why now question ahead of the curve. So they're going to adopt these kids years after all this stuff happened?
That's what I took out of it, yes.
And these folks deserve what happens to them.
We see the news van just stop inside the corn because one of them wants to get a shot of it. Garrett wants the story as he spots Angela and her son. And apparently, this Rosalind Allen, she hated this Terrence Knox, this guy that she's supposed to be getting with. And if you know that, it's really easy to see because she just has a resentment in her eyes every time she comes across this guy. And I listened to the commentary of this. The director had a relationship with this woman, not a personal relationship, but a professional relationship. He put her in all his movies. And yeah, this tension was pretty high on this set due to this relationship. Angela agrees to give the two a room in town. So these two just kind of blow through town and she gives them a room. Boy, that must be a nice gig.
Yeah, she must be desperate for some dick. This guy she's never met with this. He has the Chris O'Donnell Robin problem where it's like, I get he's written as a teenager, but you look all of 28, so it's immediately off-putting.
We go back to the news van as they drive in the corn and stop. They get out as a storm cloud hovers, and we're getting some Lawnmower Man-type POV shots. The van won't stop as a Twister comes into view. They get out as we hear some chanting in the background of the score, and one of them is killed by the corn. By the way, it's sliced in the throat with leaves while the other kids get shanked by an ear of corn that splinters the windshield.
It doesn't just slice them, but for some reason, this is like electrified corn stalks going through it. This video game type of predator vision that they decide to include here and then electrify the stalks like Emperor Palpatine is he who walks behind the rose going, good, good. As these things, oh my God. Goodness gracious. I can't believe this was actually released in theaters.
You know what, though? Here's the thing. This was coming on the heels of Lawnmower Man. So I see a lot of these effects, and I think back to Lawnmower Man. I can see the similarities.
And it's, you know, knowing what was made literally the same time as this film from Dimension, these same effects are used in Hellraiser 3. Hell on Earth, which was filmed like, if you turn the camera around, they're filming the downtown scenes of Hellraiser 3.
Oh, well, it's funny like, you mentioned that, because a lot of this crew worked on Hellraiser 3 as well.
Yeah. So they literally filmed it at the same time.
Uh-huh.
But these effects, yeah, it's very clear. That's what's. Yeah, I'm surprised we don't have CDs sticking out of some of these cornrows the way that they fucking do in that film.
If you peel the corn stalk off, you'll find a cassette player. I will say, I had a lot more fun watching this movie than I did with the first one. And there's one part in this movie coming up that I had to pause. I was laughing so hard. It wasn't in an unironic sense. I think there was something that was genuinely played for humor that was surprisingly pulled off. But right away, we're at the second movie, and they're already going full-blown into, like, when you're stock deep in slasher cliches, where we're just going to make it about the kills. And we're on the second movie.
They usually wait till at least the third. We see a very uncomfortable dinner as Garrett talks to the son about what happened to his parents. He says his parents' blood was for the corn, as Angela tells Garrett to just leave the kid alone. We learn that Garrett used to write for Newsweek, and now he's a tabloid beat reporter. And you got to remember, Adam, I know you remember this. The 90s were all about the tabloids, and they were looked down upon as opposed to like the people from Newsweek. So this is a little bit of a conflict we're getting here.
Yeah, those were big. Before TMZ,
Yeah. You
had not just extra, but you had like hard copy and stuff that was really tabloid, just dirty feeling type of journalism that was a precursor for Jerry Springer and things of that. Post Donahue and Sally Jesse Raphael, boy am I fucking old, things that just were the result of it. And yeah, the tabloid journalism, it was big for a while.
Yep.
Now it's just moved to the internet.
Yep. How funny is it that this dad calls his son Bub? I got a kick out of that when I saw that.
That's what I call Alex. So
is it really?
A little offense.
That's great.
Yes, it is. Because he was, you know, a hair's breadth from being named Logan. So yeah, when I talk to him, it's Bub.
Yeah, if I heard Bub one more time, I was going to start looking for Hugh Jackman.
So this kid and his dad, they make the mistake by making Dan mad, and that's now Dan's choice to be who he needs to be. Dan decides he's going to be on the next bus out. Later, Dad. We cut to Dan on the side of the road as more POV shots happen. And speaking of Lawnmower Man, how great is it when this kid is... Like, exactly in the Lawnmower Man movie where he somehow gets taken over by He Who Walks Behind the Rose, and he's like, he has parts of his face that come out in this digital style. Oh, man, I was laughing at this.
Oh, when he falls into the hell portal, yes. That looks like the game over sequence for Mortal Kombat 4.
Yeah, what you have is exactly what my notes are written down. What in the Lawnmower Man hell has just happened to this film?
We meet Lacey, played by Christy Clark, and let me tell you, 15-year-old me knew that he was going to marry this girl. She tells Dan that the next bus isn't until Tuesday, so he's got a bit to wait. Meanwhile, Garrett's trying to find out why the previous adults are dead as he spots Micah outside. Micah is actually looking for Mordecai as more POV shots happen and he's being chased. And then we, as Adam said earlier, it's in my notes too, force lightning as he's taken to some more Lawnmower Man type effects and his face is taken apart.
Oh, is this the guy in the church?
We're not there yet. Almost.
Oh, okay. Because I'm going to be honest, I watched 2 and 3 back to back and I just want to make sure I'm getting my chronology correct.
We cut to Micah, who says they need to wait for He Who Walks Behind the Rose. He says it is written that a leader will appear through the corn. The kids doubt these prophecies, though, as Micah appears and says that there is a power greater than all, and it is among them.
All right, so this came out, what, 1993?
January of 93, yes, sir.
How did you not have a tagline, if you stalk it, he will come?
There are so many corn puns that they drop, and there was so much potential for that, I agree with you. He saw the light from within the corn, and that the truth is not within them. We cut to Dan walking amongst the rows and seeing the kids walk. Micah appears, and Dan tells Micah that he was going to leave, but he saw a hot girl on a motorbike, so he decided to stay.
Come on, who hasn't?
We then see Garrett get shooed away from a house as the kids reappear, and the lady at the door is convinced all the kids here are evil as her husband never came back from the fields. She goes back in the house as Garrett sees some kind of mud drawn across the wall. More on this later. Dan is back in the car saying there's nothing to do out here and that he didn't have much choice but to stick around. He walks past the kids as the woman tries getting rid of the cross on the wall. Dan's back walking around town as he sees Lacey in a bikini taking a bath in the waterfall. She invites him to join her as she asks if he's ever seen a girl before.
You know, it's at this point I actually had to look and figure out because I didn't check beforehand. I was like, this had to be made for TV because they keep teasing you're going to see for nudity, and then it feels like it's pulled away like this was a two-night miniseries on CBS or something.
Yeah, and then there's parts of this that are made with the decency of a Pureflix movie. This relationship is so platonic for most of it, and I have expected Garrett to actually show intimacy with Micah's mother, but it never happens.
It does. They have sex later, and the actress said that she hated every minute of it.
If you want to call that sex.
Yeah.
But it's sex in name only.
We see another reason why cats are going to be the death of us all, as poor old Mrs. Burke goes out to get her cat from under her house, only to get killed when they drop the house on her.
Okay, this, I think, actually really works for what it's trying to be. It's creative, for one thing. Certainly more creative than I thought these type of movies were capable of being, but they do the Wizard of Oz thing of her legs sticking out from underneath the house, which makes it even funnier.
There is,
like, as far as like being meta and like referential, I think this works better than it has any right to be.
I agree. I kind of like this, Adam.
No,
because
it's so slow. It's, I understand she's old, which is the only reason. That cat should have been able to pull her out of the house by the time this thing will. It's creative. The fact that this house is on Jack, you know, I mean, if you don't know that's something that actually happens. You know, in the Midwest, you would never understand what the hell is happening here. Like, did she crawl under a car and now she's under a house? But it's creative, but I don't even know why there's adults. Okay, I'm going to stay there. I have a problem that there's adults in this movie. Because it makes no sense why suddenly this town is repopulated when there was none in it in the film we just watched. I have no idea what the hell is going on.
And that leads me to believe this is not... Well, because this is not Gatlin. It's technically Hemmingford.
Yes.
That's the way you get around that.
Yeah, this is the
building. One of the buildings says Gatlin on it. Or at least one of the buildings we see with the kids. So If we travel to
they adopt the kids from Gatlin, put them on the bus to go to another city.
Correct.
Granted, it must be like, you know, moving from one New York borough to another, because it's clearly the same location, just with a different name. But I can't take this movie seriously. I think it's impossible to look at this as anything other than schlock. So the fact that she is physically incapable of moving faster while the house is coming down on her, I can't do anything but laugh at it.
This isn't as silly as it gets. But yeah, it's the fact that they actually at least did have they knew what they were doing enough to turn it into a Wizard of Oz with the legs sticking out. They know what they're doing. You gotta at least say, hey, they know what they're making here.
Lazy and Dan, they start getting to know each other as she says that there's literally nothing to do in Gatlin and moves in for a kiss. Boy, is this kid whipped.
She said, sorry, I'm attracted to guys because I've never seen a woman before.
He says that they're leaving as soon as his dad finishes the story that he's working on. He's just mad that his dad never spent any time with them. Lacey tells him that her parents are dead as a result of a car accident. And she tells him to take her to New York with him. So now we're getting a sob story with this chick.
She has a motorcycle. That's how we were introduced to her. Get out of town.
Exactly.
You.
Yeah.
No, she can't because they killed the one person who runs a gas station within 200 miles.
It is ironic that we took, last movie they were going, it literally was Fievel Goes West, and they took the exact same thing, and now it's Fievel Goes New York.
Fievel Goes East. We then get to the one scene from this movie that I remember, and I still like it. I think the scene in the church with this nosebleed is pretty effective. And I love how, of course, in the background, we're hearing about how movies are so full of violence and sexuality, and it's going to be the downfall of us all. But I think the scene in the church is kind of fun.
I don't understand how he possesses sheer voodoo ability, but I guess that He Who Walks Behind the Rose has the same religious power set as the Force, where you can just do whatever your mind is capable of thinking. Surprisingly gorier than anything I thought we would get. The Foley work on this and the blood work as it's like trickling down, and I thought they were going to do the poltergeist thing where he ripped his face off, but it's very hard to take seriously. Like this movie really is a dark comedy, more so than the first one, because the first one plays it deathly serious for almost all of it. I think this is effective, all things considered, and I will say this movie is far more surprising in what it's doing than I expected. It's not really coherent, but it's certainly entertaining.
Stay with me on this. So I hate this scene because it freaking takes forever to get from A to B. This scene takes forever to end. However, I love the gore and what's going on with it, because I was like, oh, damn, it keeps escalating and keeps escalating. And then when you think it's maxed out, it keeps going again. But then I hate the fact that it's just Micah sitting in the back with a little freaking piece of wood whittling away this. If you have those kind of powers, what can he do? What can he not do? Why is he doing it? Why does this go on so long? Why does the sermon keep going? Why this dude is starting to bleed out in church? Maybe they're waiting for him to tithe, you know, before they were going to shut it down. But it's just, I don't understand the rules we're living in.
I mean, this is literally the church set from Hellraiser 3. I half expected Doug Bradley to come up and say, do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
We see Garrett pull up to a schoolhouse as some creepy chatters in the background, and he takes pictures of some drawings.
Oh, you mean the school from Springwood Elementary?
Yes.
I half expected to see a girl in a body bag in these hallways.
A huge crash happens. We don't see a little girl, but we see an Indian who appears and says, now, isn't this just like a white man? So this Indian comes out of nowhere.
What the hell? This is as offensive as getting a Mexican to play an Indian standing in a pile of trash with a tear going down his cheek. What the hell is going on? Look up that reference for people that don't know 80s commercials.
This is almost as offensive as casting George C. Scott to play a Native American in the Steve. Oh, wait a minute.
Wait till next year. So this Indian says that he knows who John Garrett is, as he shouldn't leave his wallet in the car when it's not locked. You know, as much as I hate this Indian being here, I like his fucking lines. He's got some real sarcastic, funny lines.
So this guy reminds me of the bounty hunter character from Jason Goes to Hell.
Oh, yeah.
Where he feels like he's from an entirely different story, but when he shows up, he's the most interesting lead character, so I don't mind that he's here, but he plays his lines with the deadpan slate of like a Leslie Nielsen film. Like, that wallet gag is something you would see in The Naked Gun.
being that we've got Rosalind Allen in this, is the absolute perfect connection.
Yes.
She's in those.
Yes.
For one of them.
Frank Redbear then says that white man always takes until there is nothing left to take and life is out of balance. The kids went apeshit and killed to get their land back. Well, this dude's no help. We see the police show up at the house that crushed the woman, and of course the kids are right at the scene. We have this woman just yelling to let the wolf in at the door. So there's this, like, there's a whole bunch of shit going on here. Meanwhile, John tells Dan that he doesn't want him hanging out with any of the kids here, but he has to go find something to do. Micah tells Dan that adults are hypocrites, and adults are all about not sinning after they turn 19. So here's something that they bring up in this movie that they didn't in the last one that I think kind of works. We have the 19 age limit here.
Yeah, I mean, it's inferred in the first one, but it's not outright said. But this is the exact same plot as Return to Salem's Lot.
It is, yes.
Where it's the virus that has affected the town is trying to convert the drifters who come through.
Not that one, but the birthday thing, I can't believe we're just going to hit all the exact same beats, and all we did was give them fresh adults to do it to.
Yep.
Like, that's the only thing we did. You got a busload of kids. This was a peaceful little town. You brought in a busload of kids that killed everybody in their town. People started dying, and you don't realize the kids are the problem on day one. Chief Wiggum could run this police department?
It's like Santa Clara was a good town until the damn corn showed up.
Micah then says that the Bible teaches that there is a season for everything. John investigates the nosebleed death, and the doctor is mad when John brings up the green mold that he spotted earlier. So this green mold, red herring, because it's implied that, and this is why I kind of kept quiet, Adam, while you're going on your tirade about the nosebleed death, it's implied that this green mold is the cause of everything for a bit, but that gets thrown out pretty quick. But for a while there, we're thinking that this is what's causing it.
Well, his name is Red Bear, not Red Herring. Yeah, it's almost like it's like a happening where you think something is possessing people and it turns out it's nature. Yes. That's kind of what they're leading you to believe here. I thought they were going to do, like, this town was built on a Native American burial ground, especially since they evoke, there's a recital and they go to, like, this, I don't know, shrine coming up later on. But I also don't like, this is not the movie to put an environmental message in.
That's exactly what, that's going to be my exact next.
Stay in your lane, Children of the Corn 2.
We hear that.
That's like Jason Takes Manhattan being advocacy for recycling since he drowns in toxic waste at the end.
And here, I thought that this mold stuff that we were starting to see, I thought it was going to be that the corn was at risk.
Yeah.
And that it was going to be some type of disease, and that's why these kids were doing what they were doing to make it go away. And nope.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking too. Like, there had to have been a reason why all this was going on, but again, it just kind of gets thrown out. So it is a plot that they could have ran with, but they decided to, as Matt said, stay in their lane. We learn that Mrs. Burke went crazy when her husband cheated on her, and that John doesn't care about anything unless it makes a good story.
Speaking of Hellraiser 3, isn't the main character in that also a reporter?
I believe so. I haven't seen that movie in decades. Yep. So
it's the same fucking production team. Yes. Wouldn't surprise me if they used the same script and just changed shit.
Adam, you're more familiar with those movies than I am. Go ahead.
Yeah, she's the one that's investigating what's going on at that club with the totem and cameraman in tow. It sure as hell is. She even looks suspiciously like our lead here, just a little bit longer hair.
The doctor makes a phone call saying that John is starting to figure things out. Meanwhile, Red Bear, he takes John deep in the woods as they find that the place has power, as a tribe of farmers were there years and years ago, and the land was disparaged and the kids killed their parents, just like in Gatlin. And sometimes what you learn conflicts with the truth. So, of course, we have to have the wise Indian find these drawings and tell the white man everything that happened.
Yeah, the only reason he's not the mystical, magical Negro is because he's a Native American. This is a Stephen King trope in and of itself.
Exactly. We cut back to the doctor, who's visited by the kids and then killed by getting stabbed to death. And they leave a sucker in his mouth for some reason. John asks Angela why she's there, and she says that she used to be really successful, but when her aunt died, she sold the condo that she lived in and ended up here. And then, of course, we have the obligatory sex scene, which Matt apparently slept through.
Yeah, my brain wasn't the only thing that was asleep during this.
Which, as outlined earlier, was really tough for this actress to do since she hated this dude. Dan sees that his dad got lucky as he walks in the house, and then he sees the kids outside. Micah is preaching about he who walks behind the rose, and Dan walks up as a sacrifice is about to take place that will join Gatlin and Hemingford forever. So this is an interesting thing that they have going on here, is we're joining these two factions of kids, and I think that could have gone okay if it was executed better.
You could say that about this entire franchise.
That's true. They chant, "We are one," as Dan is spotted. Micah tells him to come forward, and Micah asks him to be a soldier for He Who Walks Beyond the Rose, and Danny says yes.
I want to say, because I'm crapping on this movie, because, well, I'm fertilizing these rows of corn is what I'm doing. But this Wish version of Justin Long, Ryan Bowman, he's not bad as Micah, a little bit different. I think just getting somebody who doesn't sound like a whiny 10-year-old at least has a little bit of a better presence than we got last week. His voice is better to listen to than him and Death Hit the Behind the Rose, because the little balls hadn't dropped last week.
I agree with that. He's a better presence than last week's Franklin, but although, again, keep John Franklin in mind. We're going to be seeing him again. We cut to Dan and Lacey as they walk to the top of a house, and we get a real Can't Buy Me Love moment as Lacey is admiring the view. Dan is nervous, and they get down, and she says that if he can catch her, then he can have her. I love this as a teenager, but I'm watching as an adult, I'm like, ooh.
Oh yeah, this is one of those things where it's clearly written by people who don't understand contemporary teenagers.
Yes.
I think I dated her about 4 times.
And Matt, you know, we joke, but these are, like I said, these are same guys who worked a lot on a lot of those Tales from the Crypt episodes, and you can see a little bit of those tropes going on here.
Yes, but Tales from the Crypt also had really strong directors that did a lot of those episodes.
Of course, yeah. David Price, I don't think, ever directed one of those episodes. They run through the corn until he catches her, and then they kiss. But the moment is ruined when they find that they are laying down on a hand. Lacey begs Danny to get out of there. This will ruin anything, I guess, if you lay on a human hand.
I've done some things in a lot of places that I maybe shouldn't. A lot of parks, outdoor areas. For example, I think it'd be really hard to miss human remains strewn about, because as soon as they look to the left and right, there's body parts everywhere. Yes. Okay, the smell alone has got to make it hard to perform.
We cut back to Red Bear and John, who find corn that is covered in the toxic green mold from earlier. They figure out that the mold is what is affecting the entire community, causing madness and hallucinations, especially in children. But again, this is just a red herring. They run into the sheriff, who threatens them with a gun. We cut back to the kids, walking with a remote control as they take... Here's Matt's favorite scene. They take a wheelchair to the center of the road, right through the window where a bingo game is going on.
This is the fitting out of something in Jason Lives. Like, this is so... This does not belong in this movie, but it's so goddamn funny.
I laugh so hard. Same actress who played the woman from earlier who got crushed by the house, by the way. She's playing her twin.
I want to be laughing at this. I want to be having that joyful fun that I can have with, like, Jason Lives and Jason Takes Manhattan. But I heard the washer buzz, so I got up and I moved my clothes to the dryer and didn't even have the courtesy to pause the movie because I was so upset while this was going on.
Oh, dude, you missed the best scene of the movie.
Oh, Laura came out and told me he said bingo. I was like, I don't care.
And by the way, who has fun during Jason Takes Manhattan? Okay.
This guy.
And how obvious was this dummy?
Oh, yep, this is right out of, like, Death Wish 3.
Yes!
And,
This feels like it was made by Canon, not Dimension. Micah tells Danny that it's time. We cut to the sheriff tying up Red Bear and John, saying that he's going to kill them. He's leaving them to a huge harvest machine because he doesn't have to explain how it happened. What is the point of this? They roll around trying to avoid the machine as Angela is visited by the kids and taken hostage. We see Red Bear and John, they're in the corn as they escaped, and they see some bodies, and Red Bear says that there is a higher power controlling all of this. We then go to a town meeting as a woman says there's something evil which has gotten a hold of their children. And speaking of the children, they show up to the meeting and chain the door as they spread gasoline and light the building on fire.
I like how it's the opposite of Freddy Krueger's origin, where the people get burned alive.
Micah says now that all the adults are gone, it is time for the new harvest. They chant, "We are one," as they get Danny to pledge to He Who Walks Behind the Rose. They reveal that Angela and Lacey are to be sacrificed. Danny raises the machete as Lacey says that she loves him, and Red Bear and John appear in the harvest machine. Oh boy, he's pretty quick to chop this chick up. He grabs this axe and he's going to do it. But Danny ends up letting them loose, and of course, we knew the Indian was going to die.
No, you kidding me? I didn't see this coming at all.
Yeah, I thought he was just going to walk into the Rose of Maze and fade off into nothing.
Fade off into nothing. One kid is stabbed as they tried to escape. He Who Walks starts to move in the ground. Same shots that we saw last week, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, that shit that looks like it's from one of the Tremors sequels.
Yeah.
Tremors 5 borrowed footage.
So they run back to where they started. Nice editing here. Which, the editing here sucks. Micah tells Danny that he disappoints him. And then he tells them to kneel as Micah is covered in forced lightning. The Indian isn't dead, though, as he starts the harvester and Micah is sucked inside. He begs for Danny's help as the fire gets closer. And how about these morphing effects as Danny is sucked inside? We get a massive explosion as John gets Red Bear out of Dodge, though Red Bear does indeed die.
You know full well the VFX team was watching this in the theater going, we have transcended the status quo. We have got the next breakthrough in visual effect. And then two seats behind them is James Cameron laughing like Robert De Niro and Cape Fear.
You think James Cameron saw this?
Oh, I'm sure he did. Remember, his ex-wife was in one of these.
They build a sort of corn shrine to him as they set him ablaze, Return of the Jedi style.
What a Star Wars imagery in this movie.
I know. Danny asks if Lacey really meant it when she said that she wanted to go to New York with him. And of course, she says that they'll talk about it in New York as they're all walking through the rows. John says that they will tell the children's story, as Danny says maybe Newsweek will give John another chance. And then we cut to one more scene as Red Bear leaves the shrine and disappears as credits roll. On Children of the Corn 2, The Final Sacrifice, boys. All right, scale of 1 to 10 corn stalks. What do we give Children of the Corn 2? Adam, sir, you go ahead and unleash.
There's no reason for this movie to exist. I kind of wish I knew what I was getting, and I don't see how we keep going down from here, but I guess we're gonna. Clearly, I did not have a good time with Children of the Corn. I don't know why this movie exists. I'm angry that I had to watch it. I'm angry that people paid these actors and actresses, and I use those with the biggest quotes that I can put. I'm angry that somebody got paid to direct this, because this got put into theaters. You know what? This is Dimension, and Dimension does schlock, but you know what? If I'm gonna one day rate Hellraiser, Hellraiser 2, and then we get to Hellraiser 3, I've got to take the movie that's in front of me. Same thing with Hellraiser 4 and 5 and 6 and however many it goes. I know this movie's telling me, hey, you should have some fun with it, but I can't. I don't understand the story. I don't understand the why and the choices to do it. I feel like everything here was just lazy as all hell. I think, I don't know if this was a tax write-off or a way to get money from a studio to go up someone's nose once again, but I just, I'm not having fun in a movie that I guess on some level tells me that I'm supposed to. So I may be the only one. In fact, listening to this, I probably am the only one who liked this less than the last one. And I liked it considerably less, but I think it's going to get worse. So my score is going to reflect that. You know, this is the Children of the Corn scoring system, which almost has to be its own thing, which is crazy because I think we said that about Salem's Lot. I think we said that about Carrie, and I think we said that about the Chinese. So I'm going to give it a 3 because I like it considerably less than I did last week. And I want to give it a 2, but I think I got some 2s and 1s down the road, so I'm going to hold on to those. But, yeah, I'm giving this a 3, and I think that's a generous 3 for me because I just – this was – I feel like I watched a 5-hour miniseries by the time I was done with this hour and 25-minute movie.
All right, that's the score from Adam. Matt, how about you, sir?
If you would have told me going into this retrospective that I was going to like a Children of the Corn sequel more than the original, I would have said, okay, the odds of that are pretty high considering there's 11 movies in this franchise. But the gap in enjoyment I had between this one and the previous one, it's almost like the Mariana Trench disparity. But this movie still sucks. It's still too tied up in the problems and the inadequacies of this premise alone. The acting in this by the main two leads is really bad. If you're here for logic, God help you if that's what you're looking for, because there's no hope. But goddamn, parts of this are just utterly delightful in the way it just fully embraces the cheese. The only thing that's missing is a plate of nachos with the amount of cheese you can find in this movie. So I kind of equate this to something like, it's not quite Maximum Overdrive, but it's in that level of, there's no way you can take this seriously in any sort of level, but I had a damn good time with this. But I will say, preface my comments by saying this is a movie best enjoyed after a few beers or beverages of your choice, and it might improve your score considerably. So if I gave the first one a 3, I'm going to give this one a 6, because I probably at least like this movie twice as much as the first one. But also keep in mind, this is on a Children of the Corn scale. Don't put this 6 up against another movie I've given a 6, because they're incomparable.
You know, there have been times this year when me and Matt have completely clashed heads, and this isn't one of them. I'm completely lockstep with Matt here. I find this movie enjoyable for all the wrong reasons, but still, as somebody who grew up in this era and was craving stuff like this as a teenager, I can kind of take myself back, watch this movie, and find the same exact laughs I found when I was a teenager. But as an adult, you watch it, yes, the lapses in logic and everything else is pretty bad, but this isn't nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. Honestly, I think that wheelchair, it's worth watching just for that wheelchair death alone. I'm sure that clip's on YouTube. Just pull that up, and if that is your bag, then go ahead and seek this movie out. It is worth watching. If you're a horror aficionado like me and Matt are, if you're like Adam and you kind of come in and you are not looking forward to the experience of watching a Children of the Corn movie, then you're going to be deeply disappointed. But lower your standards, man. Just kind of take this movie, watch it, and there are some really, really bad acting choices. There's some really bad directorial choices. The script is a fucking mess, but goddamn, the makeup effects and everything else kind of come to play, and I found more enjoyment out of this than I thought I would. I want to go with Matt on the corn scale, on the corn stalk scale. You got to lower your scales for this, boys and girls. If you watch this movie and you're expecting a movie on the scale of like Aliens, like we covered earlier this year, you're going to be just completely out of whack. But take a bag of popcorn, put this on with a smile on your face, and I think you'll have a good time. So yeah, I'm exactly with Matt. I got a 6 going with this one. And you know what? I don't think it's going to be our last 6. I think there are some things in next week's movie that we'll have a lot of fun talking about. So this isn't going to be a retrospective that is all down, despite what Adam says. I think we're going to have some fun with some of more of these movies coming up. But that's coming up next week. We're going to do Children of the Corn Urban Harvest, Matt, because Urban Harvest means we're going to be going to the hood next week.
Yeah, might as well have Leprechaun join alongside them.
It took my joke.
All right, until next week, when we get to Children of the Corn Urban Harvest, for everything there is a podcast. Thank you, boys.
We must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos will satisfy him. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No. He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Why don't you put that in your gun and smoke it?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
And keep coming back as the boys will continue going through the works of Stephen King in publication order.
I want you too, Malachi.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You guys all belong in an asylum somewhere, loony bin. Where are your parents?
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, for we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the Mad Max movies, Avatar, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You are a sinner. You are out of fire of the corn. It will do you no good to curse me. The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Assuming that it's ever stopped.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, you're gonna keep visiting Isaac. It's probably something you should know. It's a small town. People are gonna talk.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
But you've come back to us.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
That'll make us just like them.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
There ain't nothing out there, Mordecai, except a lot of corn. Stupid old corn.
See you around.
I love this. One of the companies associated with Children of the Corn 2 is Corn Cob Productions.
I thought that was a joke when I saw
Since you're going to cornhole us for 9 more of these.
Cornhole. Nice. We cut to Mordecai, who says that they need to wait for He Who Walks Behind the Rose. He says that his...
Correction, it's Micah.
That's right, it's Micah. Yeah, I have it.
Yeah, Malachi was the last movie, and Mordecai is a movie I will never talk about on these airwaves.
Okay. He Who Walks starts to move in the ground. Same shots that we saw last week, by the way.
Yeah, that shit that looks like it's from one of the Tremors sequels.
Yeah.
Tremors 5 borrowed footage.
You laugh, but later on we're going to see some really good borrowed footage.
I thought you were going to say later on we're doing the Tremors movies. I'm like, oh, please.
No. So they run back.
I kind of wish I knew what I was getting, and I don't see how we keep going down from here, but I guess we're going to. I'm angry at this film. I'm angry that it exists. I'm angry that I had to watch it. I'm angry that people paid these quote-unquote actors and actresses and director to actually make this film. Sorry, I got... Can you hear the blower outside? Okay, yeah. I'm going to pause. I'll let Matt go. Sorry. Cut me off.
Okay.
Cut it.
All right. Why do you have to make me edit? All right, Matt, go ahead. All right. That's the score from Adam. Matt, how about you, sir?
If you would have told me...
Because urban harvest means we're going to be going to the hood next week.
Yeah, might as well have Leprechaun join alongside them.
It took my joke.
Adam, why don't you finish up your score?
Do I sound okay now to you? He's down the street a bit.
Yeah, okay,
he's
good.
Literally right. He was right up against my house. Fucking like. All right,
Jesus.
I know. All right, so going into this one here.
All right. Until next week, when we get to Children of the Corn, Urban Harvest. Oh, I had my quote up and then I lost. Okay, for everything there is a podcast. Thank you, boys.
This is the end!